Welcome to VentureCast 29. I'm Craig Severson of Grunt Media.
And I am David Hornick, and this is the Hanukkah edition.
Here in the smoking room.
The smoking room. Craig is objecting to my new furniture.
It came with its own zip code.
You have to admit that my old furniture had some issues.
Yeah.
It was raggedy. It was a little raggedy.
It didn't look like it came from my Aunt Selma's house.
Exactly. So
one has come from my Uncle Thurston's house.
Come on.
Big.
Talk to
leather.
Pamela about it. She picked it out.
Oh, then it's perfect.
Thank you. It smells good.
Yes. It's a little large. So you have now David has rather forebodingly large leather couches and chairs.
Do you think that it's in any way inappropriate that my chair, that I can't reach the floor while sitting in my chair?
I think it's a little odd.
You think that's a problem?
No fault of yours. It's the chairs are too deeply set back.
They are.
Yes.
So
part of the thing about being large.
Yeah, well, the suggestion was I needed throw pillows. But you know,
but
when you
your feet,
throw pillows what? To remedy the overly large chair.
And then you bring in the Sultan when you have business meetings here so that
exactly.
You all sit on the floor. Maybe that's what you should just convert this to a sushi restaurant style office. Cut a hole in the floor.
You're a large man. You must be comfortable.
I'm comfortable.
Don't
yeah.
You feel
no,
that's comfortable.
I'm comfortable, but I am having an aesthetic problem with scale.
All right.
I'm feeling crowded. See how it's crowding over there against your desk? Your rather large desk, I must say, also. But anyway.
Can't believe it. I should have known that you were going to jump right in.
No, I'm kind of cranky right now. So
why? What's your problem?
I've been cooped up, and I'm bored.
All right. Sorry.
I came off the horse on Thanksgiving. Didn't really. I mean, I hurt something. You know, I could have
so that's
considered.
That's a euphemism for you fell.
Falling off. Yeah. Right. Coming off.
I came off like, you know, so you're on a hiatus or you were thrown.
I wasn't thrown. No, I have a very nice horse. It was totally my fault. But it's one of those terrifying things where the saddle slips off and you're
riding
sideways on the horse.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a long story, which I won't.
Hurt yourself and you were.
Landed on my head, which is the good news.
Oh, jeez.
Helmet, of course. And nice soft dirt rather than like the rocky terrain and trees that we were just in. Had I fallen off, I would be sitting here now impersonating a cucumber. But
great.
But yeah, no, it was because my back was out the day before for non-equestrian reasons. And so when I landed, I got up and my back was fine. So it was like this perfect adjustment. But then a couple days later, I think I had a hairline fracture in a rib. And I went riding again a couple days later. And then that became a big hair fracture in my rib, I guess. So I was like, you know, hearing Depeche Mode. If I turned properly, I could hear it coming out of my side.
Just can't get enough.
So I've been lying low for the past week or so, just kind of like recovering from.
Did you type?
I could type. I just couldn't laugh.
Oh, man. Well, yes. So do you want me to play it straight?
Play it straight, because, yeah, you crack me up so much as it is. No, I'm fine. It's much better now. I can extend my arm. I can. My foot didn't break, which was another thing.
That's a good feature. All right. Well,
but I don't know. It doesn't just.
I'll try.
I'm bored with everything. I'm bored with Facebook. I'm bored with.
Holy cow.
I'm bored. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, fine.
I mean, maybe because everyone's been talking.
No, skip it.
Boring.
I think we should skip it completely.
Okay.
This is a Facebook free. You know, in fact, I had this. I remember there was a time. In the early days of VentureBlog, when I declared a moratorium on Google, like I just can't, there
no
will
more.
Not be a discussion of Google because every post it was like, and now I will post on the trees in the sky. The trees are beautiful. Google, Google, Google. You know, and now I feel
Google
like
trees.
That's, you know, don't you think that's like where we are at Facebook?
Yeah.
There's been a challenge to get to the moon, where the rover will be tracked on Facebook.
Exactly. Exactly.
Upheaval in, you know, the Middle East and
due to a new ad model of a Facebook.
Yeah.
No, we have the same thing on the Mac shows. It's always about the iPhone and our media shows. It's always been about the red camera. So yeah, these things happen. These news cycles.
All right. Forget it. We're done.
Okay.
What else you got?
What else you got?
Well,
you said there was something. We were talking about cash before the.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about this fact that out in the tech world, people are sort of musing about the fact that Apple has over $15 billion in cash.
And this is cash. This is nothing to do with the stock right now. This is just cash.
No, this is, you know, they've made more money than they've spent by to the tune of $15 billion. In fact, what was interesting to me as I was flipping through these numbers is that for Apple, that's truly the case. Apple has 15 point whatever billion dollars in cash and zero debt.
Mm.
So, mm-hmm. you know, it's cash. They spend it, buy back stock, do a dividend. They never have done a dividend. So the next two biggest, or actually the two biggest companies, are Microsoft and Cisco. This is tech, Fortune 500 tech companies. So
next biggest in terms of cash.
Total cash on hand. I'm not, I don't want to talk, you know, God only knows what GM or GE or
M1.
Any G has, you know, on hand. Mm. Although one G company, Google.
What are you talking about, G? That kind of G.
No, like GM, GE, get it, G.
Got it. Google. They all start with G.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about some sort of securities terminology.
Gee whiz. No. You sure it was your rib that was injured? Good Lord. Google. So you, when I asked you the question, which tech companies have the most cash on hand, you thought Google. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is actually Google's very close. Google, what did I say? 13 billion?
Yeah.
13 billion on hand compared to Apple's 15 billion. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're far behind. And as we know, you know, that takes a quarter for Google to then exceed.
Or
so
not
they
buy
don't,
something.
If they don't buy something with cash or do something on a dividend level or whatever, then Google will be the number three pretty quickly. And actually, Microsoft wasn't much higher. Let me see.
Wasn't it 24?
Microsoft. I thought Microsoft was huge. It actually has just under $19 billion in cash on hand. But that's because they've paid out literally billions in dividends in relative recent years. And Cisco, which is the largest cash holder with $24.5 billion, also has been paying out dividends. So, man, they must have had a lot of cash if they're paying out dividends. And but the interesting thing, frankly, I'm just not sophisticated enough to understand why Cisco would have $25 billion dollars on hand and then have $6.5 billion in debt.
Loans.
You know, maybe they're making more money on their cash than they're paying on their debt, and someone's doing something wrong. That's all I'm saying.
So they're mortgage loans.
Right, exactly. I just hope it's not, you know, negative amortization.
Well, that was fancy.
Dial 1-800-943-HOPE. No, President Bush, that's 1-888-943-HOPE. He got it wrong. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, yeah. The president, he announced that for families that were having trouble with mortgages, they were going to lose their homes, that the government had created a relief program, and that to, you know, look into it, you should call 1-800-793-943. I don't know what. HOPE. H-O-P-E.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people immediately started calling 1-800-blah-blah-blah-HOPE. And it turns out it was some evangelical hotline.
Oh,
it was because President Bush got it wrong. It's actually 1-888. You know, whatever the number is, HOPE. So, you know, the HOPE people at the 1-800 number, they're apparently, according to NPR, their mailbox is full. So you can't even leave a message.
Oh, man. Didn't they have a website, FOPOD, too, recently?
Yeah. Mm.
It's confusing, that technical stuff.
The details.
Yeah.
www. 1-888. You know what I'm saying?
Nuclear.com.
It's tough. Yeah. It's tough to keep track.
So what about cash? So what are they going to do with it? Apple should buy somebody. People are saying Apple should buy somebody.
Yeah, I just saw the speculation. Did you see what the number one vote is for?
Nintendo, isn't it?
Nintendo.
But it's a Japanese company. That's hard to do.
Yeah, Nintendo. What, because of the Wii?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What else?
TiVo. TiVo was the one that I kind of thought, well, you know, I mean, they're not like money maker.
Yeah, what are you going to pay? $3? So great. Then they'd still
$300 million
or something. Still have $15 billion.
Right.
I know. We spent yesterday's interest on TiVo. What are we getting next?
Yeah, I know. Do you have to spend cash?
No, there are no rules.
Yeah.
There's no requirements. It's just the market.
Mm-hmm.
The street. The street will punish you.
Mm.
They don't like to have too much cash on hand. On the other hand, they like to see some cash on hand. And so.
But if you have too much cash, then you're a takeover. You're a target for takeover, aren't you?
I suppose, but not at that, you know, that good
big.
Lord, their valuations are so nutty. So I think it's mostly just considered bad form this day and age that if you're not growing, but the reason Apple doesn't have a problem is that they're continuing to grow shareholder value without doing big acquisitions, without putting out, you know, dividends. So they haven't had to use it to drive share price, whereas you know, Microsoft has put out big dividends over the past years because the share price has been relatively stagnant. And there's some suggestion that, gee, if they weren't dividending out money, then people would sell off the stock and it would drop even more. So they're sort of propping up the share price.
So that is that's the motivation for dividends. I mean, the new world.
It is a motivation.
The old world, it seems like everyone did dividends back in the old days.
Right, it was this asset class, and I owned old Standard Railroad and
I got myself
coal.
A dividend.
Get your dividend and you use that for your retirement.
Yep.
What do I know? Seriously, what do I know about the public markets? I'm just a private market guy. I just invest in these quirky little companies and, help them try and grow.
Yep.
That's the venture business for you, Craig.
Like Meebo and VideoEgg? That's close to your heart, probably.
Yeah, that's good, exciting.
So what happened there? They partnered? Can you talk about it?
I mean, if it's written about it, you're reading about it.
I'm written about it. I'm reading about it. Came out yesterday.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, what's happened is VideoEgg is partnering with a lot of folks that have rich media content and are driving these rich media experiences, whether it's a Meebo experience or online gaming or online video or whatever. Mm-hmm. We have the great platform to help folks monetize that traffic in interesting ways. And then the good news is because when I say we, I mean VideoEgg, because VideoEgg is reaching across all these networks, then they can say to Ford or to Menin or to Apple or whoever, hey, what's the demographic you're looking for or whatever. We can get to them in the natural mm-hmm. context of things that make sense.
Yeah.
And that's been really fun to watch, and I think that's a space that's going to grow a lot. VideoEgg is one of the primary third party monetization engines for Facebook. Mm-hmm. I said it. Darn it!
Can't help it.
All right, I owe you a quarter.
There.
and for others, we're looking forward to Open Social for these application providers to be able to monetize across a larger set of opportunities. So. Mm. Which is cool. I was giving a talk this morning, and it was my old.
Were you dressed that way?
Yeah,
you were.
Well, what do you want me to wear? A
collar.
Costume?
A collar.
A collar.
Anyway, go on.
So
it's Silicon Valley.
Yeah,
it was rather casually dressed.
I wore very clean sneakers.
Okay.
Converse.
Yeah, right.
So I was sort of talking about what was I talking about? Oh, talking about viruses. How viruses take hold, etc. And that I think that what's interesting is that in the viral world, you sort of talk about vulnerabilities and the idea that physical vulnerabilities in the body allow for viruses to penetrate and take hold and then make you sick. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, if you look at what's happening in Facebook with the Facebook platform and with Open Social, it's really essentially allowing for viruses to take hold and propagate within the platforms. Only in this instance, they're positive. They're actually adding a bunch of value. But you could see ways in which if you had the wrong set of applications or they overtook the system or whatever, that they could in fact be malicious.
If they overtake the attention, right?
For example. If they miss or they're misguided in the ways in which they demonstrate attention share information. Mm-hmm. But again, we're not talking about Facebook, so we wouldn't be implying anything there.
Right.
I'm just saying. So anyway, it was interesting. It's interesting. I may actually come out of my blogging hiatus and venture blog.
Yeah, what's up with that? That's an old. I looked at us like this old entry about the lobby.
I know.
That's so November.
Exactly. Maybe So I'm flying to China a week from Sunday. Mm. So maybe that's a long flight. Mm. I can't imagine I'll sleep the whole time.
Right.
So maybe I can do some blogging.
And that Wi-Fi that you got going on there and. China Air.
Did you hear this announcement? Actually, this is interesting.
The Americans finally getting around to it?
JetBlue is going to provide Wi-Fi on their flights. The only thing you can do, according to the news I saw, was email, and the only email you can use is Yahoo. How is that?
That's it?
Yeah.
No web surfing? No.
Oh. They don't want you to use the bandwidth, so you can check your email and send your email on Yahoo.
Huh.
Doesn't that seem like crazy?
I think Virgin America was talking about real web when I was on a flight. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, right. They had it. They had it in some flights on Lufthansa.
Yes.
Because I remember getting emails from, I think it was Joe Ito was emailing the Six Apart board from Lufthansa at one point.
Mm-hmm.
This is a while ago.
But they've had it for a while.
You know, it's a stark contrast to United. where, you know, God. I go on United, I get the United business class, and you go to plug in your computer. You have the, like, stupid United thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
First of all, it's this stupid proprietary thing.
Yeah.
And you go to plug it in, and there's, like, a panel that's been secured over where one might plug something in. And they say, yeah, you know, as a cost-saving measure, we didn't actually wire all of the business class for power. What are you, crazy? Like, business class travel, and you're not going to provide power because you are saving costs.
Right. And it's like every third one or something. It's like you have to be lucky to be in that seat to get
crazy.
Power.
You have to go on one of my favorite sites. Do you know what that is?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead. Tell me.
Seat Guru.
Seat Guru, right.
Have we talked about this?
Yes. Oh, but right. No, they don't know which seats
they
are powered.
They do. Well, in theory.
In these individual planes.
In theory. No, no, you're right. If the planes have been screwed up or wired or closed or whatever.
And guess what? It's United, so guaranteed.
It's pretty arbitrary. Yeah, so, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about the, you know, my whatever executive status on United. Feeling pretty pleased that I've got that built up.
Woohoo. Yeah.
Yep. Gotta put that to good use.
Jeez. Somehow.
In fact, you know what's interesting? In flying to China, I could have flown direct on United, or I could have flown through, what's just north of Seattle in Canada?
Vancouver.
Vancouver. Sorry, Vancouver.
Yeah.
I could have flown to Vancouver and then Vancouver to Beijing on Air Canada. Bing, 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 bing. I took Air Canada.
Yeah.
Their seats are so much better.
If you get the right plane.
I checked.
They got a lot of old
planes. I checked. You know how I checked?
Seat Guru.
Thank you. Seat Guru.
Have you invested in them?
No, I just think.
That's fine.
You got to admit, that's just like a great service. Like,
yeah,
you know, where else could, before Seat Guru, where could you get that information? Now.
You couldn't.
You say, okay, I'm flying on Air Canada, and then it lists all the Air Canada jets. And then, you know, sometimes, it's a 777 configuration 1, 2, 3. And so maybe you don't know which configuration is. But if you look at them, by and large, their configurations are basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see. So what I did, so I checked, and it turns out that their long haul planes in Air Canada are either lie flat seats or they're whatever the next best thing is.
Yeah.
They call it. Whereas United didn't have that at all.
Yeah.
So it would be like, you know, sleeping for 16 hours and it would be like sitting in my office.
Yeah.
And my feet still wouldn't fit the reach of flight. I'm the only man in business class who's annoyed because the seats are too big and they like hit the back of my knees. Everybody else is like, woo, get lots of room. This is a problem with being a small person.
Yeah.
A little person.
Yeah. From the mailbag.
That's just in. Dear Craig and David.
We get mail. I'd never read it, but I thought, well, you know what? It's time for the mailbag.
All right.
Episode of this show.
That's excellent.
This is from Peter in Melbourne, Australia. Really great show. Don't know why I laugh, but I do. Maybe one day it'll make sense.
This is why you're pulling it up, so you can... So from Melbourne, they can like make fun of us.
Don't know why I laugh, but I do. I love it.
All right.
Good. I don't know why.
You don't need to know why.
It's not even funny.
Enjoy.
It's great hearing conversation over here in Melbourne, Australia, where it sometimes feels like we're out of the venture loop. I spend 2 hours a day in the car listening to podcasts.
Wow. That's a lot of hours.
Yeah.
In Melbourne, they must have a lot of traffic that I don't know about. I guess it's a big city.
Yeah. I haven't been. But thank you, sir.
That's it. He was just...
Yeah, yeah, no, it's just very short.
That's what you got? Yeah. I thought it was like a question. Ask Craig and Dave a question kind of observation. That's it.
I like that one.
Okay, good.
Yep. But Robert writes.
Thanks. We have another.
Yes.
Oh,
I'm just pulling, I thought I'd pull out some representation. Yeah.
Of our incredible fan mail quantity.
And I actually get this one a lot. Maybe you can ask David sometimes how he says no or how VCs say no to an entrepreneur or just let them hang. Also, it'd be interesting how quickly they make up their mind on deals, like when people walk in, shake hands, after the first presentation, after reading an email, etc.
Wow, that's a tough one.
Yeah, a lot of people do ask. How does it work?
You always say
you invest in people, and that's kind of like okay, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, it's a good question. I mean, I actually think that the no process, even having now been in the business for 8 years ish. That no is still the hardest part. And it's not contrary to popular belief, because I think that there is a sense that venture capitalists don't say no because they're sort of keeping open their options and whatever else, is that, you know, people throw their heart, you know, their heart and souls into these companies. They're excited, they're energized, you know, and it is in many ways a tough thing to time and time again have to say, I don't believe in your vision.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so the wimpy thing is that you sort of put it off. Like, yes, sure. You know, I try pretty hard as a general matter to get back to you after a couple, you know, within a couple of partner meetings when we've had a chance to talk about it, right? Have a chance to sit with the rest of my partners and describe, because what we do in partner meetings is we say, oh, what'd you see this week? Right. And if we get to it, then we talk about this week. If we don't get to it next week, whatever. But these are the companies we saw. Here's what they do. Here's what, you know, I like or don't like. It's interesting. What do you think about this space? What do you think about this team? What do you think about ad generation in this particular area? Mm-hmm. What do you, you know, is this particular chip, you know, doable within the laws of physics? Those sorts of things. We do have, these conversations.
So now, if I might interrupt, when you take a meeting,
yes,
is it just generally one of you in terms of partners? You don't
most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time.
At least on the first pitch, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. Unless something is moving very quickly, it's being introduced by someone we know well who's urging us to see it, or we know there's a reason why it's likely to be engaging, etc. I'd say 95% of the time, it's one of the five of us in the partnership meet with someone and look into the deal and say, is this interesting? Discuss it with the full partnership. And then if the partnership thinks it's compelling or interesting or wants to dig into more, then you figure out what's the next thing. Okay, should we get in front of another partner? Or should we ask industry, or, you know, dig into the technology? Whatever the thing is that's sort of in question, and try and get more data. Mm-hmm. And over time, you get enough data to either say, no, I think it's not enough of a market, or I think this isn't the right team, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or you get enough data to say, wow, that's very interesting. And in fact, as we originally thought, it's sufficiently interesting to just say, let's put some money in.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you say no? I mean, actually, I think lots of people say no in different ways. When do you know? You know, some of the time you actually know quite quickly. Someone's describing something for you and you had envisioned it as being something different, and it falls in a category of things you've looked at quite a bit. And you already know it's not a space in which you think there's a lot of opportunity. You think it's smallish, or you think that there's already a big winner, and so it'd be hard to come up with a circumstance in which you can compete, etc.
Like a new search engine.
Right, exactly. But on the other hand, you know, if it's a big enough market, this is the irony. So that's absolutely the case. Like, gee, there's some giant competitor that owns the space, for example, in routers. You know, guess what? A new router, that might be challenging. On the other hand, if someone comes in with some compelling new thing that is a new, great new way to look at routing, or a great new search engine or whatever, then you look and say, gee, the market is so huge that even discounted by an incredibly small likelihood of success, it may be sufficiently interesting that you say, I'm gonna try it, see how it goes, right? And, you know, keep in mind the venture investors have a portfolio of investments, and they tend to have a portfolio of levels of risk. And I don't think we do this intentionally, like, okay, this one's a 10 in risk, so let's do a 1. On the other hand, over time, you see a bunch of things, and you will say to some of them, wow, this is so interesting that let's see how it goes. And if it makes progress, then we'll keep investing. And if it doesn't, we'll say, well, that was a noble experiment. And if it had worked, it would have been worth a pile, but it didn't.
Right. So if someone comes in teamless, is that generally like a bad sign? Do you need a team ahead of time, or do different firms treat that differently? Like, will they say, we'll find you a team, or?
Yeah, some do. I mean, you know, there's certainly certain early stage investors that are helpful in that respect, you know.
Okay, so that's reserved for the angel stage then.
Not solely. On the other hand, you know, if you're talking with a Jeff Clavier or the first round capital guys, or, you know, or Ron Conway, or those, you know, these sets of people, Peter Thiel, these early investors, oftentimes they'll say, interesting idea, let me hook you up with this person, or, you know, what you really need is X, and let's figure out how that happens. Sometimes venture investors will do that as well, or they'll say, wow, this is a fascinating enough idea that I don't really care about the team. You know, and as you know, I mean, there are varying degrees of belief in that team versus market or whatever. Paul Graham, who I think is just incredibly smart and thoughtful about how to build startups, and particularly build early stage startups, has made the observation that if you can't convince one other person to work with you on a project, that may be a bad indicator. You know, it doesn't necessarily exclude you instantaneously, but it is a point of reference.
Yeah.
So as a general matter, if I'm an entrepreneur thinking about going out to raise money, I think that I would try to mature the idea in the company sufficiently to have engaged more than just myself in believing that this is a worthwhile project.
Yeah. Now, with August, the different partners have different areas of specialty. Is that right?
Yeah.
So in these partner meetings, these guys might be talking about, I don't know, oil centrifuges. And you're sitting here saying, I do social networking. So, but that probably makes it interesting, right?
It's very interesting. And I think, in my partnership, there are five of us and we range from, and it's not that anyone has a specific area that they, in which mm-hmm. they invest. In fact, as a general matter, we invest quite broadly.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, you know, my partner, Andy Rappaport, is a great chip investor. I mean, mm-hmm. he invested in Atheros. He's invested in Silicon Image. He's invested in a lot of very interesting forward-looking chip companies. But on the chip space, you know, my partner Dave Marquardt has done chip stuff. My partner Vivek Mehra has been a hardware engineer at Apple, built the Cobalt cubes. You know, so these guys can. I don't know how much technical help I'm adding on the how do we assess a next generation microprocessor company. Mm-hmm. And then there are varying degrees of other things. You know, my partner John Johnston and I look at software investments and have dealt in consumer and enterprise software. And so I think that there's a lot that we have to bring to bear in there. But at the same time, obviously the Cobalt experience and a number of things Vivek has done have been software related. It's hard to not give Dave Marquardt a little credit in the software space, seeing mm-hmm. as he's sat on the Microsoft board for 20 some odd years, mm-hmm. you know, among others. So I think that we try and stay as broad and helpful as we can across these things, both in understanding that, you know, in some instances, storage, right? My partner Dave has been, you know, was the very first investor in Seagate, mm-hmm. has been a number of storage companies, and then still is on the Seagate board as part of their recent buyout. And so if we're looking at a storage deal and you don't listen to Dave, then that would be look kind of nutty.
Yeah. Like,
hey, David Hornick, what do you think of this storage deal?
It holds a lot of things. That's good.
Yeah. Is it big?
Is it big?
Yeah.
We'll hold my son's loops of his...
Yeah. So, you know, we're not talking about container store.
Yeah.
Okay. My son's loops. So you raise...
We're
going to hold off on that.
I'm going to stay on this one. So,
okay. All right. We're still on what?
We're still on new VC or new entrepreneur coming in. Round one goes well. You go to a partner meeting. They're saying... Let's check it out more.
Yep.
Some time goes by. You guys do some internal research. You send the interns off to do the research.
If we had interns, that'd be great. We are the interns. So whoever's deal it is sent off to do his own research.
His own. And then, so there's another partner meeting after that. Maybe you come back and say, hey, this does look cool.
Yeah, there's some, you know, some work is done. Maybe the company meets with someone else in the partnership. Mm-hmm. They say, yeah, it's interesting. You talk to potential customers. You get a sense of the market. You do a lot of talking with people about the team themselves. Oh, people have worked with the mm-hmm. members of the team in the mm-hmm. past and the kind of how entrepreneurial are they and how thoughtful and et cetera. And so let's say you come to the conclusion that this is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about this. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty interesting. I think there's some challenges, X, Y, and Z, but it's, you know, we talk about it at a partner meeting. Everybody says, yeah, let's get this team into the partner meeting.
Okay.
And what that means is, okay, you're going to come in, you're going to present to the whole partnership. So
this is the callback of the audition.
This is the callback. This is like the big moment. And different firms do it different ways. Some firms do it very early. They say, well, you know, might be interesting. Let's bring them into the partner meeting. Hmm. And then if it's interesting, then we'll do some digging. You know, August is a place where we do a lot of digging before we get mm-hmm. to that point. So if you get to the point of a partner meeting, it means you've made it through a lot of hurdles. It mm-hmm. doesn't mean you're getting funded.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to handicap it. You know, on some weeks, everybody who shows up at the partner meeting gets funded, you know. Other weeks, it's no one, and it's not like how happy we are or whatever.
Right.
Just depends on the business. So you come to the full partner meeting and present to everybody. And then at the end of that meeting, then we sit around and talk about the business. Everybody has now seen the team in action, has heard about the business. We've talked about the markets, et cetera. And we decide if there are any outstanding issues. Sometimes the outstanding issue is, well, it sounded interesting when you talked about it, David, but it's not. Or, you know, oh, David, you know, well, didn't seem that interesting when you talked about it, but man, that's interesting. Mm. Sometimes the outcome is, hey, let's get him a term sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the outcome is, David, go dig in on this thing and tell us, we have a hard time believing X, and then do you have data on that? If not, then why don't you go get it?
Mm.
You know, so you go through this process, an iterative process. Sometimes it's quite quick. Other times you do a lot of work. And no matter what, at some point you have to come. There, one of three things happens.
Mm-hmm.
You give them a term sheet and try and fund the company.
Mm-hmm.
You reject the company. I'm sorry, but it's not, I don't think we're the right fit. Mm-hmm. Or they come to some outcome before you get around to it, right?
Oh,
I mean, some companies
right.
get funded while you're messing around, right?
Yeah.
You know, we hope that we at least have, we believe that ultimately people say, well, there's a lot of value in these guys, and so let's see whether we can convince them to be interested in the company. And if they are, then we'll see what the term sheets look like, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's important, right? Ultimately, entrepreneurs get to choose with whom they work. They should. Mm-hmm. They should do diligence on us. They should mm-hmm. figure out who they think will be the most, bring the most value, and more importantly, will be the least annoying, which that can't help me.
Yeah, yeah. That's your handicap. That's,
man, oh,
there's
man.
The annoyance handicap with Haga.
Yeah, Hornick, yeah. Hornick on the board, that's like a 7 in the annoying
category. Exactly. Character. Bad joke zone.
So anyway, and then you try and say, hey, here's a term sheet that's competitive in the market, and let's fund the company, and then the thing I love about being an early stage venture investor, mm-hmm. and particularly about being early stage, because this is true, is that you come in early. There are a lot of things that have yet to been proven, with which you have to deal in the long run, and then you lock arms, and basically everybody's in the same position, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's in everybody's interest to build value in the business. When you go out and raise more money, you're in the same position as entrepreneurs. You want to get mm-hmm. the right new investor at the right price, you know? So it's there isn't the kind of tension between the entrepreneur and investor that can occur at later rounds or can occur in different circumstances, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, which is why I love it. I like getting in early and being part of the early team that's trying to build some idea.
Yep. First presentation then, 20 slides max.
God, I hope so.
What do you hope for? I know that this is one of those it depends questions.
Yeah. You're going to have to come to my class at Harvard.
Okay.
I'm going to be teaching this very question, but yeah. The preview is, I want the slide on the team.
Mm-hmm.
I want a description broadly of what it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I want a market slide, but it's really basically, you know, what the context in which this technology fits. I suppose I ultimately want a competition slide, which says, you know, and it's again, further context. Here mm-hmm. are the sets of partners yeah. and competitors, etc. I suppose I want a financial slide because it gives a sense of what you're thinking. So I don't know that I care so much about the specifics of the slide, right? I don't, you're only going to make $12 million in 2023, you know, mm-hmm. or you're going to make $142 million in 2000. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But right. when I say, what's the headcount? And you say, oh, there are 12 people in 2015 with $90 million in revenue. Really? Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. or there are 140 people on $2 million in revenue in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very telling things. And yeah. what are the pivot points for the financials? What are the things that make you more money, that bring in more people, and how are you thinking about mm-hmm. that? That's mm-hmm. incredibly interesting data. And so, you know, that sort of data and how you're thinking about it, users and whether it's advertising, what's the penetration and what's the mm-hmm. click-through and those sorts of things are valuable, not because we say, oh, we're going to hold you to those numbers, mm-hmm. but because, you know, it's a very good view of how someone is thinking about their business and whether yeah. they're thinking about it realistically and what are the sensitivities. Sometimes you have a business that's immensely sensitive around a particular thing,
mm.
and then you better be really comfortable with the idea that that thing is going to be true.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's a killer because sometimes you have no idea or whatever. So mm-hmm. You have that, and then you sort of a slide that says, I want to raise $2 million and why? And why doesn't mean, oh my God, why does not mean, well, we're going to put that towards equipment and headcount. Duh. Like, what else would you put it? I guess it might be you're going to put $8 million towards marketing and $1 million towards headcount or whatever. But
right.
basically, you know, what you really want to know is, what do you think you accomplish with the money? Over what period of time will you spend that money?
Mm-hmm.
Invest that money
yeah.
in building your business, right? Those are the things that are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much it.
So how long is that meeting? 30 minutes?
No, I mean, usually you have an hour.
Okay.
And, you know, I've had really great meetings that have ended in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I've had really great meetings that have ended an hour and a half. But, you know, most people sort of schedule an hour for you and, you know, don't feel the obligation to fill it.
Yep.
And that's going to be the indicator of whether or not someone's engaged or not.
Round two, the callback. Do you need spreadsheets in this one, or do they do the same pitch?
Same pitch.
Same pitch, but with all the partners.
Well, it's, yeah, because ultimately these guys need to hear the same story, right? And you want
so you
to
want
try
the same
and change
pitch.
It. Mm-hmm. If the first pitch was compelling, then
they'll mess
do
up.
That. Do that again. You know, sometimes you have more of the team, and so the discussion of the team is people describing themselves as opposed to you describing the team. Some, you know, but as a general matter, it's exactly the same things that we want to hear. And so I wouldn't change it.
You send the whole team on the first meeting? Do they send the whole team? You should not.
Sometimes you do. It's not a problem. If you have a great team and they're compelling and all that, then, you know,
show them off.
Great.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, if you're doing a bunch of meetings, that's a big time sink for a whole team's worth of people, right?
Right.
The engineers hate it.
Yeah.
They really do. I mean, they just, you know, like, I'm VP engineering and you're going to make me go to Sand Hill Road.
Yeah.
You know, and that's great. And same thing with sales. I mean, if the sales guy wants to go to your VC meeting, things are going badly. You don't want, you want him on the road, not, you know, not sitting in VC meetings.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I love the, I thought so-and-so was going to be with us, but it turns out he had to go to GE to close a $7 million deal. Right on.
No problem.
I don't know that I believe you, but,
right,
that's,
right.
But that's fantastic.
It's a great line. So. Hey, is your iPhone on?
Are you getting some noise?
I'm getting the buzz.
I don't know which. Yeah, probably.
For those of you out there, it's not your thing. It's mine.
Sorry, people.
Ours.
I will turn off the iPhone and I will turn off the Trio since I have both in my pockets.
Right.
So sad.
I'm not sure.
Off completely, right?
Yeah, or airline mode.
Airline mode.
Would be fine on that.
I'll turn this one off too.
Well, that's good. That's good. That was good. Thank you. I think a lot of people have asked, have been wanting to know kind of the, you know, the gen. I mean, it's all so vague in general, but
yep.
Let me just say this.
I like this mailbag.
Yeah, that's good.
Let's do that. I like the mailbag.
Now, execution matters, according to Loic Lemure.
Oh yeah, who knew?
He put up a nice blog. This, you know, 10 good points about how to launch a startup.
Yep. So Loic Lemure, mm-hmm. who actually was most recently running
Le Web.
He runs Le Web, the conference, okay. Which is coming up in a few days.
Yeah.
Ah. And he also was the head of the EMEA practice for Six Apart.
Mm-hmm.
And now he has moved to the Bay Area and he has his new company, Seismic.
Oh, okay.
And he's sort of in real time video blogging the creation of a company.
Ah.
So I was sitting around actually the other night and I was reading Jeff Clavier's blog. And he was talking about the fact that he had been over visiting with Loic and that he was now an investor and they had a video,
cool.
A link to a video podcast about that. And it was, it's great because Loic and his co-founder, who I don't believe I've met, were sitting there with Jeff Clavier and there was like dueling French accents. Mm-hmm. Dueling French accents.
You're right.
And Jeff Clavier said, the problem with you is your accent is that we cannot understand you. And they're saying, but you are one to speak to us about that, Jeff Clavier. And it turns out that it's actually Jean-François Clavier. And so they were giving Jeff a hard time. You're not Jeff. You're Jean-François.
Who is this
we
Jeff?
Know the truth about you. I don't think any of them actually sound like that.
No.
Do I sound like, what is that? Like it's a bad cartoon character. Yeah. Pepe Le Pew. Anyway, so yeah, so apparently French, Mr. Yeah. Clavier mm-hmm. And his fund have invested in Seismic.
And do you know what Seismic is about?
Well, again, it's a podcasting, it's a sort of video podcasting experience, and not a lot has been said yet, although I think if we follow sort of the what they're describing and podcasting and blogging about, then we should all come clear.
Yes. So yeah, so he just did 10 basic rules about how to launch a startup, and I think, you know, they're very practical, and I like them.
Rule number one.
Don't wait for a revolutionary idea. The idea of your life will never happen. Just focus on a simple, exciting, empty space you see and execute as fast as possible.
All right, fast execution. Rule number two.
Share your idea as much as possible.
Okay, get it out there.
Yep.
Rule number three.
Build a community around you through blogging, etc.
Community. Get some feedback.
Feedback.
Rule number four.
Listen to your community. Answer questions and build your product.
So don't ignore them. Don't speak to them and then ignore their response.
Read the mailbag.
Rule number five.
Gather a great team with a very different skill set than yours. Look for people who are better than you without being afraid of it.
Yes, definitely. Always hire people who are better than you unless you're the best. Because then it's impossible.
Yeah.
Because you're the best. See,
but you're the best at that thing. So you hire someone better at something.
That's his point. That's his whole point,
diversity.
Right? Okay. Rule number six.
Be the first to recognize a problem or mistake you have made. Never hide it.
That's right. Fix it. Man, oh man, there are actually lots of startups who spend a whole lot of time trying to sort of cover up what they've screwed up while trying to fix it so that it becomes irrelevant. And, you know, this becomes this incredible sleight of hand problem where you're like, don't look over here. Don't look over here.
It becomes very irrelevant.
Yep. Rule number seven.
Do not spend time on market research, but launch as early as possible in alpha or beta versions.
Well, that is market research a little bit. Right? I mean,
that's the new market research.
The new market research. Number 8.
Do not focus on a large spreadsheet business plan. You are so sure it's not going to happen anyway.
So basically, this I totally agree with, which is I get these huge business plans that people have drafted up. And by the time they finish writing them, they no longer prove true. You know, it's like, oh, well, we had a bunch of assumptions in the business plan, and several of the assumptions have been proven wrong. Now, I actually think that there are some circumstances where the writing of the business plan is incredibly valuable, right? Because it forces you to think clearly about your business. So it's not that I discourage you from writing a business plan. That's completely up to you. But please don't do it for my sake, right? I mean, you know, venture capitalists, as a general matter, are not looking for these incredibly carefully reasoned 140-page business plans as much as understanding that you appreciate the levers for your business.
Yes.
Is it levers or levers?
I don't know. I think it's the levers.
Press the lever. The lever. Rule number 8? Are we on 9?
9.
Rule number 9.
Do not plan huge marketing. Growing with your community, loving the product, is much more powerful.
I would translate that to viral marketing is awesome.
Right.
Because it's free. Do not spend money on marketing unless you are going to get massive viral secondary effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to, you know, if you put $1 million into something and get a massive base that then is multiplicative, woohoo, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, then that may be a perfectly reasonable use. But, mm-hmm. you know, if you're getting less than a user for every dollar that you're spending, then man, oh man, that's a waste of your money.
That's a harsh reality.
And the number 10 rule for building a startup.
Do not focus on getting rich or selling your company. Focus on your users. Money is a consequence of success, can't be a goal.
Well, you know, this is an interesting debate.
It's philosophique.
Très philosophique, Loïc. I'm not disagreeing. I do think that ultimately you need to be very focused on the experience and the product and
the users.
And the users, mm-hmm. and all of that, right? I mean, ultimately, shy of that, what do you have?
Right.
But what I've seen in my partnership is that there's also this question of, is there someone there who, at the end of the day, is interested in making money, right? Not just making a product, but is focused on this question of where is the money in this business? And the combination of those two are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And the lack of either one, someone who's immensely focused on where's the money, but not on how to build a product or a service or an experience or whatever, not great.
Right.
Someone who's product and service and experience focused, but not focused on money, not great. So I half agree. I will give 10 only 5.
Well, then, and this is sort of the complaint people have about VCs is all they're interested in is, you know, returns, and if they're not getting their returns on time, then they, you know, clamp us down, that kind of thing. But you know what? It's also business reality. So
yeah, here's the thing. Companies I fund are losing money.
How dare
you? Right? It's a very rare circumstance that I fund a company that's making money.
Mm-hmm.
And in those few instances in which I fund a company that's making money, in most instances I fund them so that they will go spend money and lose it. Right? Not lose the money, oh, I lost all that money, but that you'll focus on market acceleration, et cetera, and spend. And if that is the case, then either you figure out how to get cash flow positive on that money, which is by the time you've run out of the money, you're no longer losing money, you're actually making money, and therefore you're fine. Or, and this is the far more likely outcome, you run out of money. And when you run out of money, then you need to go raise more money. And if you do raise more money, you get to continue building a business. And if you don't, you're done.
Yes.
It. And it's just the reality. It's a very interesting reality of this business that huge amounts of time in entrepreneurs' lives are spent raising money because they have a business in which they believe and they have made great progress, but they ultimately are making less money than they're spending in the name of a big business. And that's certainly true of venture-backed companies because we want really big, interesting companies, and big, interesting companies don't get started on a shoestring and then get profitable. I mean, it's just a rarity that happens. So I think you need people who understand and appreciate that the end goal has to be make more money than you spend.
Yeah.
That's step one. And then step two is, okay, now that I have done that, how do I accelerate the growth of this experience with the money that I have on hand? And sometimes that means raise more money so you can spend more money. to speed the growth of the company, even though you're back to losing money, right? So I think it's this very interesting, delicate dance that happens till you, if you have the good fortune of ultimately having a Google business model that gets scales quickly and has results in massive revenue, then, you know, $25 million is all it takes, and then boom, you're in the stratosphere. And our end goal with all of my companies is that they ultimately are self-sustaining mm-hmm. and interestingly large companies. But I don't want them to be self-sustaining and not interestingly large. And it's hard if they are interestingly large but not self-sustaining, right? Those two, you need them both.
Yeah.
Two great tastes. They taste great together. I don't know. What was that rant all about?
No, that was good. That was good. I get it. I think we've covered it well.
Thank you, Loic.
Got anything else for us?
I'm sad that I'm not going to be at Les Web.
Oh, that's right.
You know, I've been at the last two or three Les Webs. Maybe this is the third. Is this the third?
I believe it is.
I'm so bad. I go to Paris and I try so desperately to say just the simplest of phrases in ways that won't embarrass me or, more importantly, my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And in every instance, I fail. It's pathetic. It's just sad.
Maybe just not try.
I honestly, except they'd be very angry.
No, my wife had a different experience.
Yes.
She has a vocabulary of French, working vocabulary.
Yes.
Her business partner has a fluent vocabulary.
Yes.
They went on a trip to Paris recently. He spoke in French very well, and they sort of, she figured this out and saw that if she did not try at all to speak French, and was very upfront about her non-French.
Did she apologize in front of, like, I'm very sorry. Yes. I wish I spoke your language.
They were great to her. So,
it's funny. I was traveling. I was traveling once on a train, and I sat down. This was when I was, decades ago, mm-hmm. when I was a kid. Remember then when we were kids traveling on trains in Europe?
With wheels.
Good times. I think those trains were using coal. I was on the train, and I was chatting with this woman. She sat down. I think I was going from Prague to Budapest or something. And she said something to me in German, and I struggled to answer her in German, and she was very kind, and she spoke back to me, sort of slowly, and blah, blah. And then, like, a half hour into this conversation, I mean, just like, imagine a half hour of, like, just brutally bad German, and struggling along, and I say something like, blah, 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 ich bin blah, and then I say, oh, what's the word for cabbage, or whatever? And she says, for the German word, for the thing that I've just said in English, what's the word for that? And I look at her and I say, do you speak English? English, whatever. And she's like, oh, yes. I said, what? I've been struggling here. And she said, oh, in English, but you're doing so well. I thought, wasn't that nice? I mean, it was incredibly nice of her. She
was
very
gracious.
It was very gracious and charming. But then I thought, holy cow, why didn't we just speak English? She speaks such good English. Anyway, that's an aside because that's all we got.
That's all we got, our asides. There's other few things, but I think
we've done it.
We've done well. So are you here on the 28th of December?
Yeah, I'll be back.
You'll be back?
Should we try and do that?
Yeah.
Post Christmas, pre-New Year.
Yeah, this won't be the last show of the year then.
Between now and then, I will be in China.
See. Or what do they say in China? Guang.
I don't know, actually.
I don't know what I just said. I don't know what I just said. That was from Wayne's World.
Oh.
No, Zhang.
Great.
Zhang, which is excellent.
Okay, please. Would any of our Chinese-speaking listeners,
Craig, please forgive us.
Craig didn't mean it.
Whatever I said.
Between now and then, we'll find out how to say it. I actually have the phrase book because I have the little, you should practice these sets of phrases. And if you think I'm brutalizing French, imagine how I'll brutalize China, Chinese, while I'm in China.
I mean, and you're going where? What city?
We're flying into Beijing, going to Hangzhou. And then it's funny. So we fly into Beijing, the big city, and then we go to one of the small cities, Hangzhou. Do you know what the population of their small city is? 6.5 million people.
Whoa.
And it was described, we're going to go to one of the small cities so you can get a sense of the small city. 6.5 million people. That's one of our small states.
Yeah.
Actually, it's one of our medium-sized states now that I think about it. And then, that other big city.
Hong Kong.
No, I'm not allowed to talk about Hong Kong. That's not China.
Not anymore.
I'm going to Shanghai.
Okay.
So I'm very excited. I have not been.
This is a family trip.
This is a trip. I'm going with a group from Stanford Business School.
Oh, all right.
Which is going to be really fun. And they've got an incredible itinerary because it's basically, you know, everybody with whom we're meeting is either a Stanford Business School alumni or, you know, well, the CEO or the board member went to the GSB and they introduced us to the president. And so we're going to go to Alibaba and we're going to go to Lenovo and we're going to see factories. And it's going to be fascinating. I'm really excited about it. So hopefully I'll have interesting things to share when I return.
Excellent. We'll see you then. Thank you to CashFly for providing bandwidth for our show. Happy Hanukkah.
That's right. We should let this one roll out with a little Hanukkah music.
Oh, okay. You got some for me here, buddy?
What do we... You know, it's like the Adam Sandler song. That's all I got. Call your friend Veronica and celebrate Hanukkah. Light the menorah and celebrate Hanukkah.
Okay, that's it for our fair use use.
That's right. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, limited amounts.
Limited amounts.
For educational purposes.
Good night.
And farewell.